welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, September 27th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest for the entire hour is Richard Polt. Richard is the creator of the classic typewriter page. For more than 20 years, he's pursued his love of the typewriter as collector, blogger, magazine editor, repairman, and frequent typist. Most of his publications are on 20th century German philosopher Martin Heidegger, and he teaches a variety of courses at Xavier University on topics including Greek philosophy, technology, and communication. He's here today to talk about his book, The Typewriter Revolution, published by the Countryman Press. And if his name is familiar to you, it's because he was featured and continues to be featured in the documentary California Typewriter, now in limited release around the U.S. Hey, Richard.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Let's begin, as we always do, with you talking a bit about The Typewriter Revolution, a typist's companion for the 21st century, and how the book came about.
Well, yeah, it's a labor of love that grows out of really, as far as I can remember, a lifelong interest in typewriters, which kind of heated up around 2010 when I started blogging by typewriter. That is possible. And I started to become aware of a network of people who were doing similar things and doing creative new ways of appropriating typewriters. And I thought, hey, this is starting to look like a movement.
Well, you know, it's interesting with your background, because until I looked into it, you had no idea that you teach philosophy, and that's a lot of what you've been writing about. And so I'm curious how your colleagues at Xavier wonder, you know, how did they react when they realized you were typewriter obsessed?
Yeah, we call it Xavier, by the way. They've been really positive about it, actually. So I'm known around campus as the guy who has 100 typewriters in his office. So there are rumors about me, and the students come in and say, oh, wow, so you're the professor. And then my colleagues, they're pretty tolerant, and I've actually spread the typewriter gospel among them a little bit. So I have one colleague who has about 5 machines in his office, and a few others have one or two. And So they've been very positive about it.
Can you track back and talk about your sort of beginning in terms of collecting typewriters? Do you remember the first typewriter you acquired and that started the whole thing?
I'm looking at it right now. It's about 3 feet away. So, I mean, I grew up with the sound of typewriters because my father is a professor of Spanish literature, and he used a Smith Corona Electric to type up his work. My mother taught Spanish, and she used a Woodstock typewriter that belonged to her mother. And then in junior high school, I took a typing class, which I'm still very grateful to have taken, and I was about 12 years old. And my dad and I stopped at a garage sale, and he found this typewriter, which he bought for me. It's a Remington Noiseless Model 7. It's just this beautiful, glossy, Art Deco black object. So I loved it right away, but I didn't know anything about its history, and only much later did I learn that it was made in 1937. But I used it for school and then college and then graduate school, and so I used it regularly until about 1988 when I got a Mac finally.
Interesting. And I think I told you that's one that I just bought this weekend.
Right. Yeah, they're gorgeous, aren't they?
They're gorgeous. We just love looking at it, if nothing else. I mean, I need a ribbon, so soon I'll be using it, but it's lovely.
Yes, and the good news for your listeners is that ribbons are easy to find, so they are still made.
They're very easy to find, and you wouldn't know it, right? You think it's a dinosaur, the typewriter, but no. It's not exactly, but how many typewriters do you have now?
So I lost count a little while back, but it's over 300. I try to cut it down. My wife encourages me to cut them down, but recently I sold 3 of them, and I bought too. So progress is slow.
Yeah, yeah. So do you have a favorite in your collection, or does your favorite change?
You know, I have many favorites. My sentimental favorite is obviously that first one I got, which is right there with me, and I still like to use it sometimes. So that's the last one I would ever get rid of. For actual use, though, that's not my top favorite machine anymore. On my desk here is a Royal, a big Royal machine from about the same time, the late 30s. And that's just very snappy and makes a very nice sound.
I love it.
So that's one that I enjoy using. I also enjoy using an Olivetti Lexicon 80 and an Olympia and some others.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about the book a little bit. I love it. It just came in last week, and I love how it covers so many different aspects of typewriters, how to buy one, how to fix one, why it inspires creativity, street typing, type-ins, typewriter rodeos, on and on. Talk a little bit about getting the book together, compiling the book, and how you knew you had a book, when you knew you had a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really began, so I started blogging. I realized there was this movement, as I said, but it really crystallized into a project that got me excited. One day when I think I was at the gym working out and feeling kind of annoyed about the digital world and feeling rebellious, and this manifesto came into my head. Should I read it to you?
Yeah.
Okay. We assert our right to resist the paradigm, to rebel against the information regime, to escape the data stream. We strike a blow for self-reliance, privacy, and coherence, against dependency, surveillance, and disintegration. We affirm the written word and written thought against multimedia, multitasking, and the meme. We choose the real over representation, the physical over the digital, the durable over the unsustainable, the self-sufficient over the efficient. The revolution will be typewritten.
Love it.
So that was fun to compose. And then I posted it on my blog. A little ironic, I realize. But I'm not against digital technology per se, just against an unhealthy relationship to it.
Yeah.
And it kind of took off. People liked it, and they started copying it and distributing it and translating it. And I thought, you know, this is a movement taking shape, and this could be a book.
Really interesting. And just that you included so many different aspects of the typewriter, I think is what I love about it. I mean, there's just, you know, everything. It's not just a book about how to find one and choose one to your liking and fix one, but all these other aspects. And just on sort of the little sidebars. Yesterday I was exploring the blogs that you like, and that, you know, there's all this stuff going on in regards to typewriters, and I love how, you know, people of all ages are back into typewriters. Yeah,
there's a lot going on, and so it's a pretty long book, but it actually just scratches the surface. So this hobby or pursuit just seems to have endless facets. Every day I learn something new about typewriter history, or I hear about somebody who's doing something creative that I hadn't thought about. It's a whole world.
So do you think this renaissance will continue? I mean, how do you see this going with typewriters? I see that the prices of them are going up, and, you know, there's still people around that fix typewriters. Is it a trend, or what do you think? Is it going to continue?
Well, I'm not a prophet, but naturally, of course, I want it to continue. There's a similar motivation behind the director of the film you mentioned, California Typewriter, directed by Doug Nickel, who really came to fall in love with typewriters and with the typewriter shop called California Typewriter, which is in Berkeley. And so part of his purpose is just to give a boost to the shop and to typewriters and typing. And that's the purpose of my book, too. And I think at this point it's more than just a passing fad. I discuss the hipster phenomenon in my book, and some people have realized that typewriters are a thing, and they kind of dismiss it as a hipster pretension. But I think it's proved to be more than that. And Insofar as I can see the future, I see digital technology just growing and growing indefinitely unless civilization collapses, which it may. And by the same token, there will be people who feel that they need some distance, they need some perspective on it. And older technology, like typewriters or other things, vinyl records, for instance, it's a way of getting that distance, which I think people will still need and still find refreshing.
Well, what do you say to writers, since, you know, a lot of our listeners, if not most of the listeners of the show are writers, what do you say to them who feel that they're going to lose time by using a typewriter rather than typing directly into the computer?
Well, first of all, it's a very personal choice, so I don't really criticize anybody for writing in whatever way works for you. But here's an interesting quote from Javier Marías, who's a Spanish novelist who's been very successful and very prolific. There's an interview with him, and the question is, why do you keep using your old typewriter? Is it a phobia of new technologies? Is it superstition? And Marías' answer was, no, I just like writing on paper, taking out the sheet, correcting it by hand, crossing things out, drawing arrows, typing it over again, and doing so as many times as I have to. I'm not in a hurry. I don't have to save time when I'm writing. To the contrary, in part, I write in order to lose time.
Hmm.
I thought that was a fascinating statement.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Richard Polt, and his new book is The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century, published by Countryman Press. The other thing about writers using typewriters, at least in my view, is that, you know, there's the phrase, you know, vomit your first draft onto the page. And I think that can be a good idea. And at the same time, I also think writers need to slow down and maybe write a little less and think a little bit more about word choice and what they're intending to put on the page. I don't know. I haven't always felt this way, but it seems that computers allow you to write a little too much when maybe too much is too much.
That's true. So when typewriters are working at their best for me, they do make me think a little more coherently and carefully in advance, but they also make me, once I've written it down, keep going, not second-guess myself, and just put it out there. So they're very good for first drafts or brainstorming.
Exactly. And then, of course, you know, if you're going to send stuff out, you need to have it on a computer, except for those few publications or few agents that will take snail mail. But yeah, for first drafts, I love it. And but you know, the other thing about the computer is that it's so very easy to fall down the rabbit hole of the internet. And you know, you get on there and your writing is going well, but then something comes up and you have to do a little research, and then an hour is lost.
Yeah, absolutely. So people who are concerned about saving time, they should really consider that. And probably for me personally, that's the biggest issue I have with computers, and I haven't really disciplined myself enough to solve it personally. But I get easily distracted, or I procrastinate. You can always do more research, or you can always, if you're me, you can always go on eBay and hunt for your next typewriter you're going to buy, instead of really focusing on your writing. So I'm sometimes at my most productive at the typewriter.
Yeah. Will you read a little more to us?
Sure. There's a passage here that discusses just this phenomenon we're talking about. It's called Visions and Brainstorms.
Okay.
No question, it's harder to change your words when you're typewriting than when you're word processing. Typewriters do have backspace keys, but most of them have no delete keys. Correcting Selectrix will lift a character right off the page, but who wants to go back and do that for a whole sentence or paragraph? Yes, you can cut and paste a TypeScript, go at it with scissors and tape, but there aren't too many of us who look forward to that. For the uninitiated, these obvious points brand the typewriter revolution as a doomed, quixotic quest right away, case closed. It's true. Corrections aren't easy. Just as your typewriter can't advise you on spelling, grammar, format, or who won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar in 1968. But can these limitations be advantages? Can less be more? The first possible reaction to the absence of a delete key is to think out sentences carefully in your mind before committing them to paper. That can be excellent practice in memory, conceptual ability, and concentration. You may be shocked to discover how short the computer has made your attention span, how hard it has made it for you to keep a complex thought in view. The typewriter is a personal trainer for your mind, pushing you to become more focused. In this way, the typewriter makes you more decisive. With the typewriter, you commit to the story, says Liz Cook, who chose to feature typewriters in the opening event of National Youth Arts Week in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario. Whatever you're typing is out there in the universe, she says, and there's no taking it back. So that's one possible way you can react to a typewriter, is kind of think forward and be decisive.
Yeah.
So if I could read on a little bit more, there's another effect.
Go ahead.
The difficulty of changing a typescript can also have what seems to be the opposite effect. You let go. You stop caring about certainty. You stop editing yourself. Stop second-guessing yourself and simply write, mistakes and all. Start typing, keep typing, and don't look back. You may get into a trance state where you don't reread what you've typed at all. If you're a touch typist, you may even close your eyes and commune with the keys by feel and sound, letting the language pour out. Typewriters are excellent idea incubators. When it's time to brainstorm, to chase an idea and see where it leads you, a typewriter is a perfect tool. I rarely repeat the results of a brainstorm verbatim when it's time to transform it into a more formal, self-aware piece of writing. The typewriter has served as a breeding ground for ideas which I'll consult later on, but which I may find better ways of expressing. Without that initial brainstorm, though, my writing might well be dead, correct, well-formed, but lacking a fresh insight that only the typewriter can provide. We've seen that using a typewriter can have two apparently contradictory effects. It can increase your powers of consciousness, and it can make you less self-conscious. In fact, these two effects can work together. As your vision of what you want to say becomes bolder and clearer, you feel less need to fix what you've just written. You stop worrying about your writing. You just write. You're confident that the brainstorm will take you where you know you need to go. You and your machine are one. It moves when you do. It writes when you think. It waits patiently and responds at once. A writer at work.
Thank you so much. That was Richard Pault reading from The Typewriter Revolution. How'd you come to be featured in the documentary California Typewriter?
Well, the documentary started when director Chris Nickel was given an Underwood, I believe, and he found out that there was a repair shop in Berkeley called California Typewriter. He brought it in, and he kind of fell in love with the place and the people and the machines, and he thought, well, this could be a nice little short film. In the past, he's directed music videos and concert films and advertisements. And then it grew. He saw other people connected to the shop. He learned more about typewriters, about what people were doing with them, and turned into a feature-length film. And he's a perfectionist. It's really a work of art, and it took quite a few years. And fairly late in the process, he learned about me, I guess, from the people, the Permillions, who run the typewriter shop. And when I was going to be there in the Bay Area, he asked me to come in for a brief interview, and then he got a little more interested in what I was doing, and he came out to Cincinnati to film some more.
Interesting. You know, speaking of Underwoods, why are there so many Underwoods featured in films that feature typewriters?
I guess it's kind of the prototypical first half of the 20th century American typewriter. It was super successful. They made millions of them. And before the Underwood came along in the late 1890s, there was an astonishing diversity of designs. So people were just experimenting with all these creative ideas for how to get ink onto paper, and they couldn't infringe on each other's patents. So it's a really fun era to look at technically and historically. But the Underwood came along, and it seemed to have what was the best solution, which was visible typing. So on some older typewriters, you really could not see what you were typing until you lifted up the carriage. It had a four-row keyboard, single shift, typing through a ribbon, and other things that people kind of take for granted now when they think of a typewriter.
You know, I wasn't aware of this before your book, and probably before I started becoming obsessed with typewriters, which is pretty recently, since the movie, actually. I mean, I had a couple before the movie, but since the movie, which I've seen twice, it's my new obsession. And I never thought about what you see on Etsy and different sites, the metal keys that people sell as jewelry or to use in jewelry. I never thought about how they were torturing these beautiful old typewriters. And it's, I think most people would not occur to them.
Yeah. I think some of that jewelry is well-intentioned, you know, by the people who make it and buy it because they feel, oh, this is quaint and nostalgic and typewriters are cool. And if you think about the typewriters being destroyed, some of them are just junkers, honestly. Others are nice machines. And I saw a machine on eBay a few years ago that had its keys cut off, and it was a machine I had never seen before in my life, and I've never seen another one again. It's called the Aztec. So I convinced the seller to let me buy the keys and the typewriter, and I glued them back onto the typewriter, and it's not functional, but I put it on my shelf. So,
yeah, and even, you know, since I think reading your book, I'm thinking even if you see an old typewriter with beautiful keys that isn't functional, and you can pick it up for a little bit of money to pick it up to save it, you know, save it from getting amputated.
Well, that way of thinking will get you 300 typewriters plus. So you have to be selective at a certain point. Once you start paying attention and looking for these things, you realize they're everywhere because, sure, a lot of them have been junked over the years, but a lot of them have just been kept in attics and basements, and people feel they're a little too big and a little too special to just throw away. And so they're out there, and once people hear that you like typewriters, they'll give you these big old rusty things, and they'll pile up.
Well, you know, I am curious, when you started collecting, I'm wondering if you would buy any cheap typewriter you came across, because the other day I went by a garage sale and came across a Remington Streamliner, which was this gorgeous aqua, but it was this made of this cheap plastic, and it wasn't working all that well, yet it was $10, and still I passed it up. And then later I went, you know, I should have bought it. Why didn't I buy it?
Well, yeah, it might be good for parts or to fix up or just have fun or learn about it. I've actually gotten less selective as my collecting career has progressed, because when I first got excited about typewriter collecting, it was because my eyes were open to those 1890s machines, which are so diverse and so weird and almost like from an alternate universe. And I was a snob. I thought, I don't want a typewriter unless it's really early like that and really rare and really weird. And if I saw an Underwood, I would just turn up my nose at it. But gradually, because I've learned more, I've come to appreciate these more common machines. They're works of genius, too. That's why they were successful and became common, is that they're so well engineered. And they're also complex and wonderful and worth discovering. And so now I can appreciate almost any typewriter.
So I should have bought it. That's what you're saying, right?
Of course. I'm an enabler. You should have bought it.
I know. I could kick myself. It's like $10. It was beautiful. But anyway. So what about buying? What about buying online on eBay, other places? I mean, what's the best way to start acquiring these things or to continue acquiring them?
Mm-hmm. The risk with eBay is, first, you can't try the typewriter yourself. You'd kind of have to take it on faith. And secondly, it's going to be shipped to you, and that's a moment of peril for any heavy, fragile, complicated machine. So every typewriter collector has horror stories about receiving a broken typewriter, which is very upsetting. So I would suggest for the beginner, look on eBay, because you'll get a real education as to what's out there, what's common, what they look like, and it's fascinating, and it's free just to browse on there and learn. But maybe you'd want to buy your first typewriters locally. Check Craigslist, antique malls, garage sales, estate sales, or if you're lucky, you'll have a typewriter shop in your city. So I have on my website, which is called the Classic Typewriter page, I have a list of typewriter repair shops. Some of these are individuals, maybe retired typewriter repairmen who work out of their home. But many of them will have restored typewriters for sale. So that might be a great way for people to start. And those machines, if they've been really restored, are going to cost more than a thrift store machine. But they'll be working, and you'll be supporting an expert. And so that would be a great way to start.
Mm. And, you know, somewhere else is freecycle.org. I got my first manual of recent years, a few years ago, by posting a wanted ad, just a wanted little blip on Freecycle that said, you know, wanted working manual typewriter. And somebody got in touch with me and said, they had this Hermes 2000 that if I came that day and picked it up, they would give it to me. Mm. And so, you know, I'm in the car grabbing this thing and it's beautiful. I mean, it still works wonderfully. It's almost in mint condition. And now, I mean, I don't know that it would still be given away at this point, but, you know, Freecycle's another place, I guess.
Yeah, congratulations on that one. That's a good typewriter.
Yeah, I love it. I just love how it looks, and it's little. The typing isn't as wonderful as I would like, but I love it. So, you know, manuals. Why are writers mostly using manuals? I mean, it seems like very few writers are attracted to electric typewriters.
I guess that's true, and even fewer are attracted to electronic typewriters, which are electrics with actual chips. I'm not sure, but for me, there is something, you feel free and you feel self-reliant when you're with a manual typewriter because you don't need electricity. You know, the whole grid can go down, and you can still write on your machine. So that's kind of nice. And they're quiet when you're not typing, whereas an electric machine is always quietly humming, and that makes me a bit nervous.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Richard Polt. His book is The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century, published by Countryman Press. What about bringing typewriters to public places like coffee houses, libraries? My son and I were actually talking about this yesterday because he is enjoying the manual typewriter, and we were laughing about, you know, bringing it to a library where there used to be nothing but manual typewriters, and would they tell you to be quiet and not use
well,
the typewriter?
They probably would. So you want to be careful not to be obnoxious. Probably the most obnoxious thing I've done is take a little Olivetti Lettera 22 onto a plane. And I thought, well, you know, the plane is noisy. It's got those jet engines, and this won't bother anybody. But I really irritated people, so it was sort of humiliating. I'm never going to do that again. So, you know, judge the situation. If it's a noisy bar or cafe or something, you probably won't bother anybody. And those who do notice, they're probably going to be very positive. They'll be curious. They'll have stories for you, or they'll have questions. And 9 times out of 10, their reaction is going to be very positive.
What do you think about that QWERTY keyboard that seems to be for sale everywhere now? I think it's like $200, and you can attach it to an iPad. What do you think about that, or the repurposing of typewriters, outfitting them with computers?
Yeah, I think these are kind of charming and interesting developments. I have a little section on this in my book about mechanical digital hybrids. So people in the steampunk subculture have done this. They've created kind of wonderful marriages of typewriters and computers. There's a kit called the USB typewriter kit, which you can attach to a typewriter without harming it, and then it'll do double duty as a keyboard for an iPad or a laptop. And they're sort of simulated typewriters or typewriter-like keyboards. I think they're fun. And they're just a sign that people are interested in experimenting with their writing devices, and they care about them as more than just means to an end, but they also are interested in how they feel, how they look, and the charm of them.
Hmm. Do you use a typewriter when you work on your books, your philosophy books?
I use it when I'm feeling like I need to brainstorm. So I'm writing a book on Heidegger right now. It involves assembling a lot of my previous work and shifting it around, and that needs to be done with a word processor. So the outline function on Microsoft Word is wonderful. You can move sections around, promote them, demote them. You can't do that on a typewriter. But if there's an idea that I really need to think through, then sometimes I'll just turn to a typewriter and brainstorm for 10, 15 minutes, and often I get a breakthrough that way.
You know, something I was wondering about, or what I've been wondering about as I peruse these various websites and hear collectors or go on YouTube and watch videos on typewriters, is that most of the collectors and the people into typewriters are men. And I'm trying to figure this out because, of course, women were the ones using these things, right? When they came about, I mean, women were the secretaries, women were, you know, typing for the men. And now the men are collecting them, and I come across so few women into typewriters.
Well, they're out there. You're one.
I'm one.
And there are others in the collecting community. But I would say it's about 3/4 men, though. That is a fact. Maybe it's just men tend to be more curious about mechanical objects. I'm not sure, but you could do a whole history of typewriters and gender relations, and you just sketched out part of it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. But, you know, speaking of history, we were sitting looking at our 4 manual typewriters last night, my son and I, and we were going, you know, where was that typewriter? Who had that? What was typed on it? And I think on your website or you link to the classic typewriter page, is that part of your website?
That's my site, yeah.
Okay, so, and there's all this information like, you know, people posting typewriters and saying what they know about them. And I think I came across one that was intriguing. It was a Hermes, and the owner of it now said that he somehow traced it and that it had belonged to a sea captain. And, you know, it's just really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that, typewriters, the history, and how to find out what you want to find out or as much as you can find out?
Yeah, well, it's a matter of luck, mostly. Mm-hmm. Usually you won't know the particular history of your typewriter. But it is an interesting fact that most of the typewriters I find were made before I was born. Some of them were made 100 years ago. And so you know that these words sort of flowed through them, and there's a feeling of mystery and magic. And you can't retrieve the data like you could on a hard disk, but you're not the first owner, and you probably won't be the last, because if you take care of it, they'll survive your death. I think that's special. Now, if you get lucky, there might be some documents that come with your typewriter, or maybe you'll buy it from the original owner who can tell you the story. I recently got a funny little machine called a Bundy, which was made in Bulgaria and sold in Philadelphia, and a lot of papers came with it. And so I could really research the owner. There was a copy of a letter complaining about this ticket that he got, which led to this cascade of unfortunate events. He lost his job and so on. And then there was also this long draft of this stupid racist joke. So he lost some of my sympathy at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. I read that you love the Erica 20.
Yeah. That's one that I didn't know existed until recently, and it's really very rare, and so I still am interested in rare machines. Erica's were made for many decades in Eastern Germany, and The Model 20 came out around 1960, and it has a basket shift, which means that when you shift, instead of the whole carriage moving up and down, it's what we call the type basket, which is the set of type bars. They move up and down, which is easier and comfortable. And it just has all sorts of sophisticated features, just very nice touch. It's a big, heavy, portable. The one I got is green. It's just a really cool machine.
I've seen a few online, and actually, I don't know that they're Erica 20s. I've seen Ericas online, and you know, I'm so reluctant to buy anything I haven't tried out, because as I'm finding, as I've begun to acquire a few, is that how they type is such a personal thing, and that's probably not to be underestimated, right? The touch, whether you connect with it, what you're looking for, how it feels to you.
Yeah, it is very individual, and we love to talk to each other about, oh, this machine has the best touch or whatever, but ultimately it comes down to your preferences. And if you buy something on eBay, let's say, and you've never tried that model, then you don't know. And even just an individual machine can vary. If it's the same model, but an individual machine that's been treated differently over the years, or maybe things were a little different at the factory that day, there might be a noticeable difference.
Yeah. Will you read a little more to us?
Sure. There's a section on writing fiction by typewriter, and your listeners might be interested in that.
Definitely.
As sports writer Red Smith put it, there's nothing to writing. Quote, you simply sit down at the typewriter, open your veins, and bleed. A similar quote is often attributed to Hemingway, but that's unlikely. He liked to stand at his typewriter. The cold steel of the typewriter fused with the writer's hot blood. The attraction of this idea slumbers or rages in every typewriter lover. We dream of being writers with a capital W, punching out stories like the 20th century greats. You won't get any advice from me better than Red Smith's, but I can tell you about a few experiences that typewriting authors have had with their fiction-making machines. First of all, typewriters focus you on what's essential, your words. Losing what you don't really need may be the greatest gift, even if the loss is involuntary. Quote, why do I talk about the benefits of failure? Simply because failure meant a stripping away of the inessential. I stopped pretending to myself that I was anything other than what I was, and began to direct all my energy into finishing the only work that mattered to me. I was set free because my greatest fear had been realized, and I was still alive, and I still had a daughter whom I adored, and I had an old typewriter and a big idea. And so rock bottom became the solid foundation on which I rebuilt my life. End quote. This particular old typewriter served its author very well. It typed the first volume in the Harry Potter series. What isn't essential to writing fiction? Many would put the internet on that list. Yes, it's great for research and communication, but it won't write literature. In fact, it may lure you away from real writing. That's why Will Self has been composing his first drafts on a Groma Calibri, or Lettera 22, for over a decade. And here's a quote from Self, who is a British novelist. My favorite things are bicycles and typewriters because they're pure, inert pieces of metal that, when you add human energy to them, produce relatively high-speed travel or text. People are deceived into believing that writing on a computer is faster, but it's not. Using a typewriter is more disciplined. You don't have the distraction of thinking, I'll go online and look up what oven gloves made of fur look like. I think I felt oppressed by the distractions of digital media and longed for a certain level of clarity and simplicity that the typewriter afforded. The internet is of no relevance at all to the business of writing fiction directly, which is about expressing certain kinds of verities that are only found through observation and introspection. It's an incredibly powerful tool, and you'd be stupid not to use it, but it's a distraction in the actual business of writing. End quote. Jonathan Franzen agrees. In the 80s, he wrote his first novel, The 27th City, on a Silver Reed typewriter. Although he now uses a computer, which, quote, makes it easier to find fragments you've written and then forgotten about, he sees the internet as a procrastination pit. This is why, when Franzen got a laptop, he removed the wireless card and, quote, plugged up the Ethernet hole with superglue. He insists, It's doubtful that anyone with an internet connection at his workplace is writing good fiction. Typewriters slow you down a bit and call for a little more effort. That can make the difference between blurting and writing. Susanna Kaysen, author of Girl Interrupted, works by typewriter. Her editor muses, "Sometimes people who write on computers, you feel like they're just typing. When you have to type and retype, as she does, there's a kind of precision there." Gay Talese, who favors Illiterate 22, agrees that less is more. Quote, "I want to be forced to work slowly because I don't want to get too much on paper. By the end of the morning, I might have a page, which I will pin up above my desk. Around after lunch, around 5 o'clock, I'll go back to work for another hour or so." So just a few testimonials from people who are using these machines.
Yeah, thank you. That was Richard Polt reading from The Typewriter Revolution. What are some of the best typewriters for writers?
Again, as we were saying, it's very individual. So I mentioned Javier Marias earlier. He actually does use an electronic machine, and that works for him. Isaac Asimov used to use an IBM Selectric, which is probably the best electric typewriter, maybe the best typewriter ever made. It's super fast. You can switch the typefaces, and you know, it's a wonderful machine if you like electrics. People will use just about anything. Some really favored models right now are the Hermes 3000. You have a 2000. This is the 3000. Probably the best American portable is the Smith Corona Silent Super from the 50s. And people like Olympias, which are very well-made German machines.
Yeah. Somewhere I read that the Olympia is the Mercedes-Benz, or maybe that was in the movie, that in California typewriter.
Yeah, I think it's repairman Ken Alexander who says the Smith Corona is like a good old Chevy, but the Olympia is like a Benz.
And then with these different models, there are different years, because I do actually have a Hermes 3000, but I have the one that's all curvy, and I think it's from 19, I don't know. I'd be lying
probably
to say.
Early 50s, or late 50s, early 60s.
Late 50s, yeah. But I've seen them that are more angular, which, you know, must be later 60s, 70s.
Right. Yeah, it's fun to see the designs evolving over the years, and sometimes the underlying mechanisms really remained unchanged, but you see the machine evolve from kind of a, for instance, Smith Corona, which was the most successful, I would say, portable typewriter manufacturer in the U.S. They came out with this very well-engineered portable in the early 1930s, and at that time it was kind of boxy, like a 1920s car. And then they streamlined it and became this beautiful sort of modern thing. And then it evolved into a beefy 50s machine, and then a funky 60s machine. And you know, but the heart of it was always the same.
I'm intrigued by street typists or type-ins or
or
rodeos. Can you talk a little bit about all that?
So these are sort of events that people have made up in recent years. The first type-in was dreamed up by a guy called Mike McGettigan in Philadelphia, I believe in 2010. And his concept was simple. It's just, you know, I love typewriters. I know other people do. Let's get together in a public place and let's not be abashed about this. Let's meet in a pub and bring our typewriters. And people had a great time. And then this became a trend, and people are doing it now. So probably every month or so, there's a type-in in the U.S. Or in other countries. And there can be, you know, speed contests or other formal things, but mostly it's just people getting together and chatting and typing.
And what about street typists?
Sorry?
What about street typists that, you know, a little bit about that?
Yeah, so that's a phenomenon where people take their typewriter to the street and they will write usually poems or sometimes short stories for the public. I've done it myself in a group a couple of times, so it was lower pressure because there were a group, and because the way we did it, we took a little time. We said, great, thanks for your idea, come back in half an hour, and we'll have a poem for you. But probably more common is people just write a poem on the spot with people looking at them. And then you give the person your poem or story, and the person pays you whatever they're inspired to pay you, if anything. It's really exciting. I mean, even in the low-key way that I did it, it was kind of thrilling because, well, as you know, as a writer, sometimes constraints can make you more creative. Mm-hmm. So if you decide, I'm going to write a sonnet, okay, well, that specifies, you know, rhyme scheme and so on. But within that, you can be stimulated to do a lot of interesting things. Street typing, it's a time constraint. So most of the poetry people write is pretty free verse, but the constraint is you're going to do this now, and you're going to do it on a typewriter, which means you can't be agonizing and Xing things out and, you know, just put down what comes into your mind. Inspiration is going to happen now or never, and under that kind of pressure, sometimes really surprising and interesting things happen. And what I experienced and what people report to me is that often the people who ask for these poems or stories are really grateful and really touched and moved.
Do you tend to need city permits to do street typing?
People should definitely research that. I know that in New York there are some pretty strict busking rules, and so you should look into it. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't just set up.
Yeah. Especially if there's a group of you, right?
Yeah.
You know, I've found that there are few older manuals that have exclamation marks on them. And I'm wondering if, I mean, because these days, you know, exclamation marks can get out of hand in my view. I'm not a fan of the exclamation point. Did writers like exclamation points less back then?
Probably so. I mean, certainly traditionally, I think still today in fiction, if your narrative voice involves a lot of exclamation marks, you're seen as an amateur and kind of a hack, right?
Yeah.
Your characters might use exclamation marks, but yeah, I guess a lot of typewriters were used in business, and you're not shouting at your customers. You can save a little manufacturing cost if you don't put that in. People could always make an exclamation mark by typing an apostrophe and then backspacing and typing a period.
Yes. And it teaches you some restraint on using exclamation points, right? What about typewriter art, as Jeremy Meyer does shows in the movie California Typewriter? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so for people who aren't familiar with him, he's a sculptor who uses typewriter parts and only typewriter parts to build these amazing biomorphic sculptures that look like animals or people. And he's become quite successful. So in the film California Typewriter, you see him working and you see him struggling to get some recognition, which he finally does. As he explains there, some people get upset when they hear that he's doing this. They compare him to the people making jewelry out of typewriter keys. But he's convinced me that he's not a vandal. He's taking common typewriters that really can't be rehabbed, and he's, in a way, paying tribute to them. He's paying close attention to them, and he's turning them into a new thing of beauty. So that's great. And then people are doing lots of other interesting things in art with typewriters. They're modifying them, painting them, they're making representations of them, or they're using them in performance art. So there's an artist called Tim Youd, Y-O-U-D, who has an ongoing project to retype his favorite novels. And what he does is he just puts two sheets of paper together into a typewriter, and he types on the top sheet of paper again and again, reusing it until it becomes, he's copying a novel, and it becomes soon illegible, and it just becomes this really dense rectangle of ink that starts to then break through and type onto the bottom page, and it's visually interesting, and the whole process is interesting to me. And he always uses the same kind of typewriter that the original author used, so he's reliving the experience of actually typing the novel.
Hmm. Now, how would you paint a typewriter? You'd have to get the body off somehow, yeah?
Yeah, essentially you disassemble the body panels, which is usually pretty simple. You just have to pay attention to where the screws are. You need to prep it if you want to get a really good job. You want to remove the old paint, maybe blast it off in a blasting cabinet or sand it off, put down some primer, and then you can spray paint it. Or I've taken a couple of typewriters to auto body shops that do a professional job, and you get some beautiful glossy colors that way.
Interesting. Yeah, really interesting. We're at the end of our time, but we have a minute left, and I wonder if there's anything we didn't talk about that we should have talked about.
Let's see. We could talk about the history of typewriters a little bit. We talked about 19th century machines. People might be curious about, you know, what was the first typewriter. So the earliest one we know to have worked dates from 1808 in Italy, a man called Turi. And we don't have the typewriter itself, but he made it for his mistress, who was blind, and we have the letters that she wrote to him on it. It wasn't until the 1870s that there was some successful mass production. And it was still seen as an expensive curiosity, and people weren't sure what it was for. But in the 1880s, it started to take off, and then I said in the 1890s, everybody realized this is something we need. This is something that the business needs, government needs. And there were all these amazing inventions, everything from really sophisticated big machines with separate keys for lowercase and uppercase and all these fancy features, down to what were called index typewriters, where you just turn a dial or you pointed a letter on an index or something, sort of like cheap label makers today, and they sold for $1 or $5. So even if your listeners aren't inspired to start writing on a typewriter, they might be curious to start typewriter collecting.
Mm-hmm.
That, as you know, is another thing I'm into, and I'll put in a little plug for the Early Typewriter Collectors Association. We put out a quarterly magazine called Etc. I'm currently the editor, and we publish pictures and stories about collectible typewriters of all ages.
Mm. I'm going to check that out when I get back. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you for this wonderful book, The Typewriter Revolution. It's just such a wonderful book for anyone at all interested in typewriters, whether you want to use them or just understand them. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad that you've enjoyed the book.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much. That was Richard Pault. His book is The Typewriter Revolution, A Typist's Companion for the 21st Century. And I love it. And I hope you all get a chance to check it out, too. That's all for today. If you want to know more about the show or you want to listen to this show once I podcast it, visit my website, penonfire.com. And just to know that the opinions and views that you heard on this show are not those of the University of California Regents, but those of Richard Pault and me. Thanks so much for being with us. See you next week.